Transitionist.
And we're holding on page Tzadik Gimel in Rava Basra, Ois Tzadik Ches. So in that one, just the first section, Tzadik Ches. Okay, we started learning yesterday. We had a machlokas between Rabbi Yoshia and Rabbi Yochanan, between Rabbi Yoshia and Rabbi Yonason, about how Eretz Yisrael was divided. So we had Rabbi Yoshia said that Rabbi Yoshia said they went strictly according to the people who left Mitzrayim. Meaning, in other words, we said yesterday, suppose you had two brothers, Reuven and Shimon, who left Mitzrayim, and both of them passed away in the desert. Each of them is entitled to a portion in Eretz Yisrael, to a portion of land in Eretz Yisrael. And then if Reuven has more children than Shimon, it means that Reuven's children are going to be getting smaller portions per person than Shimon. To give an example that we said yesterday, here, let's do the math a little more simply. Let's say, for example, that in a particular Shevet, each person's plot, an average person's plot in a particular Shevet is supposed to be, let's say, 1,000 square amas. So Reuven and Shimon would each be entitled to 1,000 square amas. If now Reuven had 10 children and Shimon had one, Reuven's children who enter Eretz Yisrael are each getting 100 square amas, and Shimon's one son is getting 1,000. That was according to Rabbi Yoshia. Then we said Rabbi Yonasan had said it went according to those who entered Eretz Yisrael, but then it would reverted back to their ancestors who had left Mitzrayim, and then it was redivided based on that. So Rabbi Yonasan had explained that in our scenario, let's say, so Reuven had 10 sons and Shimon had one, and all 11 of them went into Eretz Yisrael, each of them would be entitled to begin with to his 1,000 square amas. So we have 11,000 square amas to work with. Then what we do is we restore that to Reuven and Shimon, the brothers. We pretend as though they're inheriting it. They're inheriting that 11,000, divide it between the two of them, comes to 5,500 apiece. So now we divide 5,500 among 10 children of Reuven, among 10 sons of Reuven, and each of them gets 550, and we give the 5,500 to the one son of Shimon. That was how Rabbi Yonasan explained it. Okay, so now the Gemara continues. Amalei Rapapa la Abaya. So now Rapapa asks Abaya. The Shleim Elamanda Amalei Yotze Mitzrayim. It's easy to understand, according to the opinion, that it went, according to Rabbi Yoshia, that it went according to those who left Mitzrayim, and we don't really factor in at all those who came into Eretz Yisrael. So in our scenario that we said before, for example, Reuven's children are getting only 100 square amas apiece, where meanwhile their cousin, Shimon's one son, is getting 1,000. Well, then, we understand. First of all, we understand then what Benoist Slavchad were complaining about, because Slavchad died in the Midbar. He has no sons. They don't know at this point that daughters are going to inherit, because only after Benoist Slavchad brought up the point does Hashem tell Moshe that daughters inherit. So now, therefore, they're saying that, look, our father left Mitzrayim. He should have gotten a portion in Eretz Yisrael. Now that he died in the Midbar and he doesn't have any sons, what's going to happen with his portion? But if you say it goes to those who are entering Eretz Yisrael, well, then in that generation, there's no sons of Tzlachod who are entering Eretz Yisrael, because Tzlachod didn't have any sons, period. So what are they complaining about? There is no son to inherit. So what do they want? They don't know yet that girls can inherit. So then what's even the basis for their argument? So the answer is Elul Chazara. Fine, but even according to Rabbi Yonasan, that it went according to Boi Ha'aretz, there still is the point that we said that then we move it back, we take the amount that's allotted to each one of them and bring it back to their fathers, and then we divide it among the children, so there would still be that point is still relevant after all, because you would still have that. So they're saying Slavchad should have gotten from his own father, Chefer, he would have gotten a portion from the land that Chefer had when Chefer's children divide up their Nachla in Eretz Yisrael. So now Chefer also left Mitzrayim, and therefore he also is entitled to a portion in Eretz Yisrael, according to that way of looking at it. So now though Slavchad died in the desert and he has no sons, why shouldn't he be allotted a portion that then we would give back as if we gave back to Chefer, and then we divided among Chefer's various descendants, but it would still come out that Slavchad and his descendants would get some portion of it. But that's what we're saying. In other words, we're saying that Maboya Oritz, Neschalka Oritz. But even, but we still say, there still is the Chazorah. We still say that whatever they were supposed to get goes back to the previous generation. So like this, Tzlofchad should have, if he had made it alive in Eretz Yisrael, or if he had, or rather, if he had sons who made it alive in Eretz Yisrael, they would get. So now, and then he, so they would get, then it reverts back to Tzlofchad and to Chefer, and then it gets divided, and on top of that, the Gemara points out later in the Perek, Tzlofchad was a Bechor, he'd get a double portion. So you would have all of that. Now that Tzlofchad doesn't have a son, why shouldn't we stand in place of a son and be able to get that Yerusha through Chazara, through the fact that it's going to go back from Tzlofchad to Chefer, and then it will go down, because Chefer and Tzlofchad both passed away in the desert.
What is their claim?
Their claim, that's what we're saying. So they're saying that, because Tzlofchad didn't have any sons, fine, Labari Oritz and Schalka Oritz, but still, so just because he didn't have any son, does that mean that he completely forfeits his right to Eretz Yisrael? After all, we're saying, even according to the Yonison, it wasn't exclusively Labari Oritz. We do factor in the Yotze Mitzrayim as well. Tzlofchad was from Yotze Mitzrayim, so shouldn't there be entitled, so L'Hazor of Little B'Nichse Chefer, there should be at least, that there's the They're going back to Tzlofchad and going back from Tzlofchad to Chefer, and then going down in the generations from there.
Tzlofchad and Chefer are Yotze Mitzrayim, both of them passed away in the Midbar.
Yes. Now, one second. One more detail that you need to know that will make the difference over here is that the Gnos Tzlofchad knew, Rashbam points out, that they learned from the parasha of Yevamim. We know that Yibum was done only when a person dies completely without any heirs. They knew as long as he has some kind of heirs, then there's no Yibum. They were able to derive from that later on. The Gemara explains Darshani Yisoyu. They knew how to Darshan, so they knew therefore that the same way as by Yibum, any living descendant counts, and therefore there's no Yibum. The same way over here, any living descendant should count, and therefore there should be Nachla over here. So all they're saying is Tzlofchad had no sons who are boy Horetz, but does that mean that he's completely forfeited his portion in Eretz Yisrael, even insofar as we wouldn't say that it goes back to Chefer and then it gets distributed among Chefer's various descendants, including them, the five girls.
So they're not claiming for themselves, they're claiming for their...
They're claiming for the whole extended family, right.
Okay.
Right. So the Gemara says, fine, here's another one. It's easier to understand, according to Rabbi Yoshia, who says that it went strictly according to Yotze Mitzrayim, then we understand that why the children of Yosef were complaining to Yeshua. In Sefer Yeshua, it tells that after, when they're in the middle of dividing up Eretz Yisrael, say that Yosef comes to Yeshua with a complaint, they say, we don't have enough land in Eretz Yisrael. Now, we're going to learn later on in the Perek, that there are different opinions, and there's opinions in the Gemara, and there's also opinions among the Rishonim, how exactly, when we talk about each Shevet got a territory in Eretz Yisrael, and the fact is some Shevetim are larger than others, is it that a larger Shevet got a larger territory, which would seem to be the case, or is it that all the Shevetim got equal-sized territories, and a larger Shevet, therefore each person is getting, relatively speaking, a smaller plot of land? Later on in the parak, it also points out the division was not just based on size of land, it was also based on the quality of the land. After all, some land in Eretz Yisrael is worth a lot more than others. But anyway, Rashbam points out that the Gemara could answer over here that, look, Eretz Yisrael was each Shevet got an equal portion, and therefore Shevet Yosef is larger, which it was in the second census in Parshas Bamit and Parshas Pinchas. Menashe and Ephraim together are the largest of the Shevetim. They have 85,000 and some men. Even the next one, Yehuda, has 76,000 and change. So if we go like that, then of course we understand the basis for their complaint. They're saying you're giving us the same size territory as you're giving to the other smaller Shevatim who are only 30,000 or 40,000 people. However, the Gemara is not bringing that point up over here, says Rashbam, because the Gemara is going to point out later on there's machlokas about that. So right now the Gemara wants a simple answer whether we say that larger Shevatim got larger territories, or whether we say that every Shevet got the same size territory we need, or if we understand that all of them got that larger Shvatim, got larger territories, still, if we say Laboi Mitzrayim, Neschalka, Loyotze Mitzrayim, Neschalka Aretz, then it becomes easier to understand their complaint. So they're telling Yoshua, we don't have enough land. Why? Because between the census in Parshas Bamidbar and the one in Parshas Pinchas, they grew tremendously. Shevet Ephraim, not actually. Shevet Ephraim lost population, but Shevet Menashe in particular grew by over 20,000 people between the first and second census. They were the largest. The largest gain in any one Shevet is from them. Interesting point. The Gemara is going to quote the pasuk. They say Asher ad Kori Berchani Hashem. So the Kori Balaturim points out Kori is Kof and Hay. So the Kof represents 20,000 and the Hay represents 500. Which was the actual increase, 20,000 and 500. Anyway,
it's interesting that the total amount is almost the same, 601,000.
Yeah, 603,000 in the first 601. Yeah, if you look at the individual Shvatim, some Shvatim lost population. Shevet Shimon lost over 37,000. On the other hand, here we're saying Menashe grew by 20,000 and change. Yeah, but it didn't come out that much different. Yeah, it's true. So the point is that if you say they went according to Yotze Mitzrayim, then we understand. Shevet Menashe is saying, look, when we left Mitzrayim, there were only 32,000 and some men in our Shevet. Now it's 52,000 and some. So it's going to come out that each of us, that many of us are going to get, relatively speaking, very small portions compared to everybody else. So Dichtiv, and the Pasuk says, Vaydabru b'nei Yosef as Yeshua lemer. So the children of Yosef spoke to Yeshua, and they said, Madur nasati l'nachla gerdel echad v'chevel echad. Why have you given me as an inheritance one girdle and one portion, meaning they're saying basically that they're saying you, now fine, your Shevet Yosef is divided into Menashe and Ephraim, but basically the Pasuk describes there, they had one large area in Eretz Yisrael, which then was split part to Menashe and part to Ephraim. So therefore, they're saying that's not right. Vani Amrav were a very large, numerous people. Hashem has blessed us to this degree. So in other words, we increased so much, even in the Midbar, even from Yotze Mitzrayim until Bori Haaretz. In fact, Mefoshim point out even more than that. When they entered Eretz Yisrael, they had an even greater increase in population, because the Gemara is going to quote soon the pasuk V'yidgul Oroi V'kerev Haaretz. So they're going to increase like fish in the midst of the land. So when they came into Eretz Yisrael, all of a sudden they had a tremendous spike in their birth rate. That was a special bracha that they had. So now they're saying to Yeshua, since we crossed the Yarden and came into Eretz Yisrael, our numbers have increased even more so. So now our families are larger on average than the families of the other Shvatim, and now you're telling us we're getting land per person only for the 32,000 and change who left Mitzrayim.
Compared to
Dogim. Yeah, that's the point. But if you say that Eretz Yisrael was divided, that each person was apportioned a plot based on the ones who came into Eretz Yisrael, fine, we're saying then they redivide it, but still, that doesn't change it. It changes the calculation a bit, of course, but it's not so tremendously less that they should be complaining about, because the fact is, fine, right now, Shevet Menashe has 52,000 and some people when they entered Eretz Yisrael. So fine, each one of them is getting, each of you have 52,000 and some hundred plots are being allotted. So what's the problem? So my kotzavchi, kulu shokul. So after all, what are they complaining about? Everybody's getting. So the answer is mishum tfolim to have an ufishi lahu. But that's the answer. They had a lot of children. There were a lot of yisoimim who were less than 20 when they entered Eretz Yisrael, and they didn't have a father who entered Eretz Yisrael from whom they can inherit a portion. Let's say, for example, they also don't have that. Rashbam says they also don't have any ancestor who left Mitzrayim. Let's say, for example, their grandfather died before he left Mitzrayim. Their father was less than 20 when he left Mitzrayim and is not counted in the first census. And now they're Yisraelim entering Eretz Yisrael, and they don't have anybody. So on the face of it, they're not. So Shevet Menashe may have had a lot of people like that, and therefore there's a problem, and therefore they're complaining that we don't have enough land. Omer Abaya. But Abaya says, Shmamina, we see from this complaint, we see from the complaint of Shevet Yosef, and also the concern about Bnei Slavchad, Loi Habachad Deloi Shokul. There must have been among all the other Shvatim, there was nobody who didn't actually get a portion. It could happen, like we just said, conceivably, that a person's grandfather passed away still in Mitzrayim, and his father in the desert, and therefore the Yisraelim are less than 20. But Abaya says, in practice, it didn't happen. In practice, it didn't happen like that. There was nobody who didn't have some kind of thing where if not his father, then he has an uncle who passed away in the Midbar that he inherited from or whatever. Because says Abaya, if you were going to say that there must have been somebody else who was in that situation, then he Baruch of the Mitzvah, and he also should be complaining. And we see the only ones who brought up a problem are Bnei Slavchad and Shevet Yosef. So you're going to answer that maybe the pasuk only lists where they complained and it actually had an effect and a change was made because of it. So b'nos tzavcha, they came to Moshe with their argument, and Moshe asks Hashem, and Hashem says, sure enough, came b'nos tzavcha d'ivros, they're saying correctly, give them an inheritance. You're going to argue that there may have been other people who made such arguments, but nothing came of it, and therefore the Torah doesn't bother recording it. But Yosef, but we see what happened with the children of Yosef. They complain, and nothing came of it. And nevertheless, the pasuk writes and tells us about their complaint. So Yeshua tells them, basically, he says, I can't give you more land than Eretz Yisrael. But he says to them, what you can do, if you really are pressed for space, you have a big forested area in the middle of your territory, in the middle of the territory of Manasseh and Ephraim, clear that forest, and you'll have plenty of places to live and to farm and so forth. So they argue back and they say we can't for various reasons, but Yeshua says that's how it's going to have to be. You need land. That's your only alternative. Actually, the Malbim on the pasuk has a very interesting explanation. Has a very interesting vote on it. The pesukim there in Yeshua say that there were certain cities in the territories of other nearby shvatim which Shevet Menashe was able to live in. So they controlled those cities, even though technically they were in the territories of other shvatim. So the Malbim says that was an adjustment that was made. He couldn't take it away from other shvatim, but he could make the deal that Shevet Menashe is allowed to live there, basically. But at least the point is that not much came of their argument, and nevertheless the Torah records it. So therefore you see everyone who complained, the Torah records. It must be then, since we only had B'nos Slavchad and Shevet Yosef, says Abaye, it must be that there was nobody else who was in that situation. So what would it be? Again, though, if we say that you go according to the Yotzim Mitzrayim Neskalka Aretz, then you would say that even if there was somebody whose father left Mitzrayim less than 20 years old and then passed away in the Midbar, then fine, you'll have some other, Hashem would have arranged, there would have been some other relative of his who was 20 years older when they left Mitzrayim and passed away in the desert, and they could inherit from him. And if you say the boy of the artist, the skalka artist, then the same thing, you would say that there was always chazara involved. And again, you would say that every person had somebody, his father or his uncles or whatever, who left Mitzrayim. So you see, because there was nobody else who complained. So the answer is no. Hosim Eitzah Toivah Kamash Malon. No, because the answer is, actually, when it comes to Shevet Yosef, there is a reason why their complaint was recorded, even though we're saying that maybe nothing came of it. Because Eitzah Toivah Kamash Malon, because from those psukim we can learn, from what Yeshua answers them, we can learn good advice. The Borla Le'inish Le'iz Zehurim Me'ein Abisha, that a person needs to be careful to stay away from an Ayin Hara. So, in other words, Rashbam points out like this. Look, what is Yeshua telling them about this business with the forest? If the forest belongs to other Shvatim, then Yeshua makes it clear to them, I have no right to give you land from the other Shvatim. And if it's land in their own territory, do they need Yeshua's permission to chop down the trees? It's their land. They can do whatever they want with it. So it must be that Yeshua is telling them about the forest to warn them about the danger of Ayin Hara. Any time there was a complaint where either it had a practical effect, as in B'nai Slavchad, or where we learn something from the reply to them, like with B'nai Yosef, and it's written. But since we don't have any other recorded, but that doesn't mean necessarily that there may not have been other people who complained, and it's not recorded because there was no difference, there was no nachtamina that came out of it, either as far as practical changes or as far as advice from which we can learn something. What advice are we talking about? What's Ayin Hara? Yeshua. So Yeshua tells them, Dichtiv, Vayom Aleim Yeshua, Im Am Rav Atar, if you are numerous people, Alei Lecha Hayara, go up for yourself to the forest. Now, in the simple sense, he's telling them, go to the forest and start clearing the land and making it suitable to live in. But it means something else as well. Omalahui means he tells them, Lechu Vehechovu Atzmachan Bayaorim, go hide yourselves in the forest, Shalei Tishlat Bechem Ayin Ra, so that an Ayin Hara shouldn't have an effect on you. So fine, you can chop down the forest and you'll have places to live. But it also means, in other words, this way you'll be more concealed by the forest, and that way you'll be safe from an Ayin Hara. Omrule, but they answered him, we don't need that. Anan Mizara de Yosef le Shotaba in Abisha. We are just, we're the descendants of Yosef. And Ayin Hara has no effect on us. By the way, Maharsha points out the word Hayar can actually be an acronym. The Hey Yud Ayin Resh can stand for Hayar Yisalak Ayin Ra. The forest will take away Ayin Ra. So they answer, we're from the descendants of Yosef. The Leshalta Be'en Ambisha, where the Ayin Hara has no effect on us. So in other words, first of all, Rashbam teaches out. When they reply to Yeshua, they say, Lo yimotze lanu ahar. So in the simple sense, it means the mountains are not sufficient for us. You're arguing that we should clear out the forests over there and build cities over there. It's really not, even that is not really enough room for us. But now, in the drosha of the Gemara, we're saying, Lo yimotze lanu ahar, we don't need that. We don't need that advice of yours to build ourselves cities that are screened by the forest because we're immune to the Ayin Hara. Or Marsha explains the other way around. It means fakert. Even on the mountains, which are more exposed to view, there won't be found lo yimotzi lanu. There won't be found against us an ayin hara because we're immune to it. The dichtiv, as the pasuk says, bein poras Yosef, a fruitful son Yosef, bein poras alei oyin, a fruitful son alei oyin. Va'omer ababo, I'll take it alei ayin ela oylei oyin, not alei oyin on the spring or above the eye or whatever, but oylei ayin, they transcend the eye, so they're higher than the eye rather than the eye being on top of them. There are a number of different explanations that Mefarshim say what exactly the drosha is, but in other words, the point is that we're saying that they were immune to an ayin hara. Elsewhere, the Gemara explains that was Yosef's schus because he controlled his eyes in the whole matter of Eishes Potiphar, so therefore he won for his descendants a bracha that they were immune to the ayin hara as well. Now, Yeshua, being from Shevet Yosef himself, should know that. Why do they have to tell him that as though it's a chiddush? So there's an explanation, I think, from the Chassam Sofer that says Yeshua took the view, the same way as we find by the brachas to Manasseh and Ephraim, where Yaakov put Ephraim ahead of Manasseh, and therefore Yeshua held this bracha of Alei Oyin primarily applies to Shevet Ephraim as well. But it's Shevet Manasseh that's coming with the complaint. And they reply to him, no, it's the whole Shevet Yosef that benefits from that bracha, us too. So we don't have to worry about Ayin Hara, so we don't need your advice about hiding in the forests. Rabbi Yosef, Reb Chanina says here's a different source for this concept that the descendants of Yosef are immune to an Ayin Hara. The Pasuk says, in Yaakov's bracha, they should multiply like fish in the midst of the land. So, ma dogim shabayam hayam or mayim chasa alehem, the fish in the sea, the water covers them, they in ayin shalat espaham, and the ayin hara is not able to have any effect on them. There's the fact that some of them are invisible because they're too far underwater, but even the ones that are visible, Mefarshim explains, like the water is a barrier against the ayin hara. So, af zara shal Yosef in ayin shalat espaham, the same way Yosef's descendants, the ayin hara has no power over them. The Ion Yaakov points out, the point of comparing them to fish in the water. We know that Torah is compared to water. So what it means is, now a fish has to be completely immersed in water, otherwise it'll die. The same way a person has to be completely immersed in Torah, and that's what protects him from an ayin hara. So in any case, they tell them that here Yeshua is giving them an advice about Yetzer Hara, about the ayin hara, and they tell them we don't need it. Elsewhere, by the way, the Gemara points out to a certain extent, all the Jewish people are considered descendants of Yosef. First of all, I mean, after 4,000 years, everybody is probably inevitably descended from Yosef on some side, you know. But aside from that, also the Medrash mentions that Yosef is considered almost like an honorary one of the others. You have the three others, and you have Yosef as considered like a quasi of as well, particularly because he sustained the Jewish people during the years of hunger in Mitzrayim. We have the pasuk, for example, Noyeg Katzoin Yosef, Bnei Yaakov Yosef Sela. So therefore, to a certain extent, we all benefit from that. And in particular, Mefarshim talk about that any person who works on controlling his eyes, then he also benefits from that bracha of Yosef and is immune to the Ayin Hara. And very appropriate, by the way. Today is the last 2 days in the Nesi'im. Yesterday's and today's Nesi'im, with the Nesi'im from Shevet Yosef, Ephraim yesterday, Manasseh today. So yeah. Now, so far we had two opinions about how Eretz Yisrael was divided. Again, we had Rav Yoshia saying that we go strictly according to those who left Mitzrayim, and we had Rav Yonasan who says that it's a hybrid, it goes according to those who left, who came into Eretz Yisrael, but then we return it to their ancestors and we divide it among them. So now, the Gemara continues, Rav Shimon Elazar Omer, La'elo La'ela Nischalka Oretz. It's actually both of them. And not a matter of chazara, not a matter of that you have to return it to the previous generation, but rather you look at both censuses, Kedei L'Kayim, Shnei Mekoros Halalu, and that way both psukim are fulfilled. In Rav Yonasan's opinions, the Gemara had brought two psukim, one that says, by the census in Parshas Pinchas, La'ela Techalika Oretz, the Eretz Yisrael should be divided to these, meaning the 601,000 and change who were counted in Parshas Pinchas. But then you also have the pasuk l'shmos matis avosim, that it should go to the names of the shvatim of their ancestors, which implies that it should go according to their fathers who left Mitzrayim. So each of them had his opinion of how we reconcile those two psukim. Rav Shimon Elazar says that we're mekayim those psukim, meaning that's one or the other, whichever category a person is in. Halketzer hoya miyotz Mitzrayim, if a person was one of the ones who left Mitzrayim, but he didn't enter Eretz Yisrael. So he was 20 years old when he left Mitzrayim, and he had children in the Midbar and then died. And even if his children were below 20, so they don't get a portion of their own, but they get by virtue of their father. Nevertheless, their father gets a portion because he was one of the Yotz Mitzrayim, and his children will inherit from that. And vice versa, if somebody was born in the desert and was, if somebody was born in the desert and was 20 years old, and when they entered Eretz Yisrael, so even though he wasn't Yotz Mitzrayim, no problem, then he gets a portion together with those who enter Eretz Yisrael. We count him for purposes of apportionment as well. The economy can, if he's in both categories, what if he was 20 years old and he left Mitzrayim, and he had children in the desert, and he died, and the children themselves are 20 when they go into Eretz Yisrael, then they get a portion from both sides. They get a portion for themselves, because they're boy Haaretz. They also get a portion because of their father, who was Yotz Mitzrayim. So that's Rashbam's first explanation. Rashbam brings a second explanation that it means if a person himself was 20 when he left Mitzrayim and he survived to come into Eretz Yisrael, and he's one of the boy Haaretz. So the case would be where Rashbam explains if when he left Mitzrayim he was over 60, because the Gemara explains later the gzera of everybody dying in the Midbar didn't apply to those below 20 or over 60. So now you could conceivably have a person himself was 60 when they left Mitzrayim, and now when they come into Eretz Yisrael, he's still alive and he's 100 years old. However, Rashbam says that's not what the Gemara means. Because the pasuk, when you have the census in Parshas Pinchas, so the pasuk finishes off over there and says, you should know, among these 601,000 and some men from the other Shvatim, there was nobody from the original census, because they all died in the Midbar except Yeshua and Kalev. So there's nothing to say that if a person himself went out of Mitzrayim at over 60 years old and came into Eretz Yisrael, that he should get a double portion. So Rashbam says that's not what the Gemara over here means. On the other hand, Rashbam brings from a Tosefta that maybe in fact it is true, that in fact they do get, anybody who Taka was alive at Yetzias Mitzrayim and alive when they entered Eretz Yisrael, would Taka get two portions by virtue of that. So now, continuing on that point, Miraglim, Yoshua, what about the Miraglim? Yoshua v'Kolev not the Chelkam Shal Miraglim. Yoshua and Kolev got the portions in Eretz Yisrael that should have gone to the other Miraglim. So in other words, what happened? The Miraglim themselves left Mitzrayim. So therefore, according to Rav Shimon Elazar, they should be entitled each to a portion in Eretz Yisrael. Their children should therefore be getting the portion that their father, that each of them, that their father should have had. However, the Miraglim, because they badmouthed Eretz Yisrael, therefore they forfeited their portion for themselves and their children, and Yeshua and Kalev got that portion instead. So the Rishoyim lost their portion, and it went instead to the Tzaddikim. Which Rashbam explains. After all, we find when Bnos Slavchad came with their argument to Moshe, they said, you know, our father was not, he wasn't among the Miraglim, he wasn't among the Misloinim, among Adas Torah, implying, in other words, that they knew if he was in any of those groups, he would have forfeited his portion and they have nothing to talk about. So therefore, so the Meraglim, instead, Yeshua v'Kolev, not Nuchelkim from Meraglim. So Yeshua and Kolev got their portion, it didn't go to the Meraglim's children. Misloinim v'Adas Korach, as far as the Misloinim, the ones who complained about, the ones who complained against Hashem in the Midbar, and Adas Korach, and Korach's book, also Loher Lahem Chelek Baris, they also didn't have a portion in Eretz Yisrael, and they didn't have a portion in Eretz Yisrael at all, and again, in other words, their children did not, their children did not inherit their portion. So in other words, Rashbam explains that just basically their chelek is considered almost like hefker. All the shvatim gain it equally. So each other person is getting a little bit more land that would have otherwise gone to these people. So Gemara says Minahani Mili. Where do we know this from that we're saying that Yeshua and Kolev gained their portions instead? Because the pasuk says Yeshua ben Nun v'Cholev ben Yefuna choyu min ha'anosh mehem. After the pasuk describes how the Meraglim, after the Meraglim died by Yemusu by Magefel lifnei Hashem, they died in a plague from Hashem. You know, the famous thing Rashi mentions about their tongues and worms and whatever. So then the pasuk says Yeshua and Kolev lived from among those men. Now, my choyu, what does the word of the pasuk mean by saying that they lived? Ilema choyu mamish, does it just mean they lived, they didn't die like the Meraglim did? You don't need that. V'oksiv k'rachrina, later on, in Parshas Pinchas, it says, clearly, ilema noisem ahemish, there was no man left from all the ones who had left Mitzrayim between 20 and 60 from the other Shvatim, kiim kolev ben Yefuna v'Yeshua ben Nun. So the pasuk doesn't need to tell us that Kolev and Yeshua survived when the other Meraglim died. So the word choyu means they lived in their portion, meaning, in other words, that there's a the portions in Eretz Yisrael that would have gone to the Meraglim, instead Yeshua and Kolev got them. Meaning, Maharsha says Eretz Yisrael was called Eretz HaChayim. So therefore, when we say Choyu min ha'anoshim ahem, they lived in their land, means in other words the Meraglim lost their place in Eretz Yisrael. They don't even have a chelik. They don't have a chelik lo'en laba. The Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin. So therefore, so now Yeshua and Kolev instead got their portion in Eretz HaChayim. The Bala Turim on the Pasuk, in fact, points out, you have that on the word choyu itself. He points out that the gematria, if you take the word choyu and turn it into atbash, so the ches becomes a samach, the yud becomes a mem, etc., then you end up with a word which is the same gematria as the word bechelkam, which is what the Gemara is saying over here, in their portion. Okay. Now, when we say misloinim v'adas korach lo heilahem chelik ba'aretz, we're saying that the complainers in the midbar and Korach's group did not have a portion in Eretz Yisrael, and we said Rashbam explains that that means that what would have been their portion instead was forfeit to everybody else. It became like hefker, and now everybody else gets a slightly larger portion because they don't get. The question is, Vatanya, but we have another braisa that says Meraglim, Misloinim, Adas Korach. As far as all three of these groups, the Meraglim and the Misloinim and Adas Korach, all of them Yeshua and Kolev, not the Chelkom, all of them Yeshua and Kolev got their portions. So what is it? Did the Misloinim and Adas Korach forfeit their portions entirely, or is it it's still reserved for them? And since it's not available to them, since they themselves lost it because of what they did, then Yeshua and Kolev specifically got it. So the answer is that loikasha, there's no contradiction. Mar makish misloinim l'meraglim. The author of this, the Tana of the second Braisa, holds that there's a comparison between the misloinim and the meraglim. And therefore he says, once we establish that the meraglim's portion was taken over by Kolev and Yeshua, then the same thing with the misloinim. Or mar makish misloinim l'meraglim, whereas the other opinion says that there's no comparison. The meraglim's portion was taken by Yeshua and Kolev, the misloinim's portion was just forfeit b'chlal. D'tanya, as we learn in a Braisa, when Bnois Tzlofchad come with their argument to Moshe, they say like this, Avinu Meis, the pasuk goes like this, they say, Avinu Meis Bamidbar, our father passed away in the desert, V'hu Lo Hoya B'Seicha Eda, he was not among the congregation, Anoyodim Al Hashem, who assembled against Hashem, Ba'adas Korach, and the group of Korach, and they continue that he passed away for his own Aveda, and the Gemara is going to talk about later on what that Aveda was. Anyway, so what's the phrasing they use when they say Avinu Meis Bamidbar, our father passed away in the desert? Is that Tzlofchad? First of all, this means Tzlofchad. Now, there's really no chiddush in saying that. It already introduces them as Bnois Tzlofchad. Rashbam explains that's just the style of a braisa wants to explain it. The other phrases in the pasuk, so it also explains the meaning of this. Rashbam brings also that there may be a couple of lines missing in the Gemara over here, because if we look in the Sifri, which is where there's in Sifri, in Medrash Halacha, on Chumash Bamidbar, which is where this Braisa comes from, where it goes through Pasuk by Pasuk and darshens it, so it explains over there, Rabbi Akiva says that you have a Gzeira Shava on the word Midbar. They say, Avinu Meis Bamidbar, whereas it also says by the Mekoshish Eitzin, by Yu Bnei Yisrael Bamidbar, when the Jewish people were in the desert, and somebody was gathering wood on Shabbos, and he was executed. So Rabbi Akiva learns from that Slofkod was the Mekoshish, as we'll learn next time, that's the Shem. So therefore, so that's what I mean. Not just Zet Slofkod, but in other words, the point is who was the Mekoshish? Slofkod. Anyway, when they continue, they say he wasn't among the congregation. Which Eda? Zuragas Meraglin. He wasn't among the group of the Meraglin. And they're called an Eda because we find Hashem says about them on Mosela Eda Hara Hazos, which is in fact where we learn, by the way, that an Eda, that a minion, is 10 people because there were 10 bad Meraglin. So he wasn't among that Eda. Hanoyodim al Hashem, when they continue, the ones who assembled against Hashem, Elam Aslonim, that refers to the Aslonim, the ones who complained. Where in fact the Rashbam explains, the Gemara is going to explain soon, that Mislonim over here doesn't mean the people who complain all the various times in the Midbar. There were many people, all of the 10 times when they tested Hashem in the Midbar, and all that time there were many times they complained. We mean specifically the complaints in Adas Korach. And Moshe says on them, Hanoy Odim al Hashem, the same expression as Bnei Slofchad say over here, that he was not from the Noy Odim al Hashem. So he was not from Korach's group.
Korach's group is the 250 people.
There's two different, there's the 250, there's also Dostan Aviram and their hangers on, yeah. Anyway, so he wasn't part of that. Badas Korach Kamashmoy, when it says he wasn't among the group of Korach, that means exactly what it sounds like. He wasn't part of Korach's group. So they're saying he wasn't any of those three, he wasn't in any of those groups, and therefore he's entitled to a portion in Eretz Yisrael, but what's going to happen with it since he doesn't have any sons? So now, Mar Makish Mislonim Loraglim. So again, going back to the two Brises before, one Tana holds that by putting together the Meraglim, and then right after that the Mislonim, implies that they had the same thing. The same way as the Meraglim forfeited their portion, and it was given to Yeshua and Kalev, so also the Mislonim. Or Ma'aloi Makash Mislonim and Meraglim, whereas the author of the first Braisa holds that they're different. The Meraglim's portion was taken by Yeshua and Kalev, the Mislonim's portion was just free for all. Or not really free for all, but whatever, it means that there was a larger pool of land available to give to everybody else. The Omele Rapapa La Abaya, but Rapapa asks Abaya in this connection, he thought that Mislonin means exactly what it sounds like. Everybody throughout all the years who complained in the Midbar. So, Lamanda Makish Mislonin Meraglin, the opinion that says that Mislonin, like the Meraglin, that Yeshua and Kolev got their portion, Ichbo Yeshua v'Kolev v'Yosef v'Chola Eretz Yisrael, whereas Yeshua and Kolev are getting more and more and they're ending up inheriting a substantial part of Eretz Yisrael. Okay, not the whole, Kula means the whole thing, fine, but Ruba, in other words, you have so many times, right? You learn who Amar Moshe. So Mela, you say, for example, Mela, you say that their portion was not forfeited, it just went into the general pool. So fine, it means, let's say, you have somebody from Shevet Zvolun or something, let's say, who was one of the Mislonim throughout the 40 years. Fine, it means he forfeited his portion. Now, when we count how many Yotzim Mitznayim were there of Zvolun, and how many Borya Arif there were of Zvolun, so fine, we deduct the ones who were Mislonim and we remove them from the equation, and then we say in that case, then that makes that now the remainder each get a larger portion in the territory of Zvolun than they otherwise would. But if you say that all of it went to Yeshua and Kolev, then they're inheriting lots of land all over Eretz Yisrael. And in fact, Rashbam points out that actually we can see from the Pesukim, they didn't even get a thousandth of Eretz Yisrael. Yeshua got a specific city in Eretz Yisrael called Timnas Cheres. Kolev got Hebron, and that's it. So Abaya answers Mislonim Sheba Das Korach Kaminin. We don't mean the Mislonim throughout all the times in the desert when they complain about the Mon and about the Slav and about this and that. We mean specifically the Mislonim in Adas Korach, where, yeah, there were only a couple hundred of them, so Yeshua and Kolev getting their portion is not such a big deal. It still doesn't amount to such a, it's still, even if you have 250 men with Korach, plus fine, Dustin and Aviram and their immediate hangers on, fine, you have a couple hundred people tops, you still have, it's among 600,000 Jews, so Taka still does, comes out to a very small percentage, where even if Yeshua and Kalev got all of their land, it still doesn't make that they have that much extra in Eretz Yisrael.
Where is Hebron? In which part of which?
Hebron is in the territory of Yehuda. So Kalev was in Shevet Yehuda. Like this, he would have gotten some portion in Shevet Yehuda. Like this, he gets the entire city. In the end, by the way, Chevron actually became one of the Ore Miklot, so it actually went through multiple changes of hands for there's actually a sikha someplace actually where it ever talks about the significance of that. You know, we'll have, for example, the amusement park Six Flags. They're called that because the original one was opened in Texas, and over history there've been six different governments that ruled over Texas, Spain, and then France, and then this and the other. So La Havdo is Chevron is the city of many flags as well, because first the Knanim, and then Yehuda in general, and then Kolev, and then Levium. Fine. Yom Yom Mashiach Ogola, Ches Nissen. We started talking about yesterday that everyone was talking about it has to be that the Umas Olam will exist lost in lava in Mashiach's times. It can't possibly be. It would be completely against Yiddishkeit to say that they should be destroyed. So now the Rebbe continues, given that lost in lava, the Umas Olam will still exist, and they will be in a standpoint of Geula as well. So it means, as a preparation for the Geula Seder, we have to work on the whole world to make them ready. We have to work on the Sakan Olam, Machos Shindal Yod, so we're poil on the Umas Olam that they should act in a way of Lashavas Yitzara by keeping the Shem Mitzvah Nenoyach, and in that way we prepare them also for their role loss in love. Continuing with Halachas of Nissen time. During the first 12 days of Nissan, we say the parasha of the Nasi, who brought the Korbanos that day. The 13th day, we do the beginning of the Haloscha until Kenos HaSamanora. Actually, we do from Zos HaNokos HaMizbeach. That corresponds to Shevet Levi. The Medrash says that Aaron was bothered by the fact that he wasn't able to participate in that, and Hashem tells him that instead you're going to have something greater. You're going to have the Menorah, which is why we read the section about the Menorah. Erev Pesach, we daven early so that a person can finish his meal before the fourth hour of the day, because after that you can't eat chametz. So you want that last opportunity to eat chametz, so you should daven early. But later on, in Siman Tov Mem Daled, the Alter Rebbe talks about when Erev Pesach comes on Shabbos, you have to daven early as well, because they're the same thing. You have to have your Shabbos so down, Lecha Mishnah, and all that before the fourth hour. But even when Erev Pesach is on a weekday, then you still, yeah. Now, the Gemara tells us that if a person makes an isur, a bonding, for the Yom Tov by eating and drinking, namely that he treats the day after Yom Tov as a special thing, isur chag, and makes it as something tofel to the Yom Tov, then the pasuk considers it as though he brought a mizbeach and as though he built a mizbeach and brought a korban on it. We say in Hallel, isur chag ba'avoisim ad karnas mizbeach. So the isru chag ba'avoisim literally means tie up the korban with the tie up the thick korban, and ba'avoisim can mean ropes, but it also means the korbanos themselves are heavy and fat. Ad karnas mizbeach, and bring them to the horns of the mizbeach. So this is why we get the name isru chag from. So when a person does that, when a person considers the day after Yom Tov, so for example, Chav Gimel Nissen, Chav Zalim Tishrei. We have the minhag to eat and drink a little extra on Isru Chag of all Sholosh Regalim, and for the same reason, nobody should fast on it, even a Chosin Kala on the day of the Chuppah. Again, not even a fast for a Yortzeit. Now again, this is only a minhag. It's Meikra Din. There's no Isru, but it's better to not Tareiz Meshubach to treat Isru Chag as something special. The Alter Rebbe points out that Isru Chag of Shavuos actually is something more special in that connection. Isru Chag of Pesach and Sukkot and Simchas Torah is only a minhag, but Isru Chag of Shavuos has more of a status of Kedusha of it because it's called Yom Tovoyach. Namely, later on in Hilchos in Siman Tov Tzadik Daled, the Alter Rebbe explains there are korbanos. After all, there are korbanos the person has to bring on the Shalosh Regalim, an Oyla Sriya, a Shalmei Chagiga. It's Machlokas, the Shama, the Hillel, whether you can bring them on Yom Tov itself, or whether you have to wait till after Yom Tov. The halacha is indeed that you could. Nevertheless, the Alter Rebbe points out many people, even Beis Hillel themselves, tended to follow Beis Shama in that and not bring the korbanos on Yom Tov, so they would be brought the day after Yom Tov, and therefore that's considered more of an actual Yom Tov itself, in that the day a person brings a korban is a Yom Tov for him. So therefore, Isru Chag of Shavuos, there's an actual Isru to fast on, as opposed to Isru Chag of Pesach and Sukkot. It's less of it, it's more of a minhag and less of an Isru.
Also,
7 days after is you make tashlumin. That's something else, right? But you make tashlumin. We don't say tachnun, but the idea of not fasting is particularly on that day. It's called Yom Tovoyach.
Why is it?
The other one.